In the days following Hurricane Sandy, media outlets focused most of their attention on sensational stories like the surges in Lower Manhattan that submerged subway stations, the explosion at the Con Edison plant, and the roller coaster that slipped off the Seaside Heights boardwalk and plunged into the ocean. But it was in Staten Island, which is often called the Forgotten Borough, where half of New York City's storm-related deaths occurred. Sandy caused more than $1 billion in damage there and displaced thousands of families. Two Huffington Post staff reporters, Saki Knafo and Lila Shapiro, spent the weeks after the storm investigating why Staten Island had been so vulnerable, and their article was the splash page on the Huffington Post website earlier this week. I'm very pleased that it has brought Saki Knafo and Lila Shapiro to our show. Hello.
Hi.
With the possible exception of the Rockaways in Queens, Staten Island seems to have come off worse than the rest of the city when it comes to Sandy storm damage. Did the storm hit Staten Island harder than the other boroughs or the other areas of the tri-state area, or was it simply that Staten Island was less prepared?
It's probably a little of both. It definitely did hit the borough very hard. If you look at the map, the water between Long Island and New Jersey is shaped like a wedge. And when the storm came through, it kind of pushed the water up that wedge, and it just hit Staten Island head on.
So is it protecting parts of Brooklyn and Manhattan and New Jersey?
Yeah, yeah.
It's acting as a kind of a buffer. Out of the 43 people killed by Sandy, Lila, in New York City, 23 of them were in Staten Island. Why so many there?
I think it has a lot to do with the way that Staten Island developed. Many of the homes that were not just in Oakwood Beach, where we set our piece, but in neighboring neighborhoods like Midland Beach, they were built originally as just summer bungalows. And as the borough kind of continued to develop, people turned these into permanent homes, and they were never built with the idea of a storm like this in mind.
And which part of the island were most of these houses located?
This is the South Shore, primarily. And that's where the most intense damage was. It's what one geologist at the College of Staten Island referred to as the bullseye of the storm.
In a HuffPost Live video, you discuss how Staten Island is underrepresented politically and also in the media. Your piece has been titled The Forgotten Borough. Why do you think it is forgotten?
I think a lot of it comes down to geography. I mean, you have to, you have to drive there. It's not really part of the, New York's public transportation system. I had actually never been there before I started reporting the story. And, I've lived in New York for 6 years. So, I mean, I think that part of it comes down to this geographic question.
Well, if the destruction was so bad, why do you think the media were so slow to report on it?
I think, again, it has a lot to do with geography. You don't have a lot of reporters living there. There are a lot of cops, contractors, plumbers, but not a lot of journalists. So it took a while for people to get there.
Well, it's interesting that Fire Island, which is in a similar situation, it helps protect Long Island from severe weather, did get more attention. It has fewer residents. It's not part of New York City. Is it because it has more affluent people who go there, who have homes there?
There's definitely that sentiment in Staten Island. People in Staten Island definitely feel that they've been neglected both by the media and the government because they're largely working class. And one woman we spoke with pointed out that in Belmar, New Jersey, where the boardwalk brings in millions of dollars each summer, they started rebuilding the dunes, the protection, days after the storm. Meanwhile, in her neighborhood in Staten Island, they were still waiting to get storm barriers that they've been petitioning the government for since basically the 60s.
Well, you say that Staten Island was largely farmland and vacation homes before the Verrazano Bridge was opened in 1964. And then those working class people all moved there? Why? Was it just that it was more affordable than other parts of the city?
Mm-hmm.
I think it was, you could have the experience living there of being in Long Island or Jersey, but it was cheaper and closer to the city. So you could be a city worker, come into the city every day, but still have a home and property.
So it was kind of like moving to the suburbs, but staying in the city at the same time.
And you
time.
Get to keep your city pension.
By the 1990s, it had become the fastest growing county in New York State. Is that still the case? Do you know?
I don't know, but it's definitely still growing. There are houses going up right now in the areas that were devastated by Sandy.
Well, you mentioned all of the places in New Jersey, the shore towns that have already started rebuilding because they're tourist attractions. What industries on Staten Island are suffering as a result of the storm?
Well, the real estate business. I mean, it is, one of the biggest businesses on Staten Island. And there's definitely, this is a pause. There are still developments going up as we speak, but it's certainly, set back to some extent because there are questions that haven't been answered yet about, rebuilding in these zones.
Well, you mentioned the real estate business. It's been said that Staten Island is a real estate borough, right?
It's probably
the politicians had close ties to the real estate industry.
Right, right. A lot of people have commented on the fact that Staten Island is the only conservative borough in a very liberal city. But one person we spoke to said, it's not the Republican Party or the Democrat Party there, it's the real estate party.
And why are the conservative politicians there? People, the two you point to most, former borough president Guy Molinari and former congressman Vito Vasella, why did they have such close ties to the real estate industry?
The real estate industry has been the biggest source of economic growth on Staten Island. People, builders there have money, especially relative to other people in the borough, and they have financed many campaigns.
And, it's also kind of part of the community. It's like they both have, direct personal ties. Molinari, he himself once invested in a bungalow in Oakwood Beach. And, like many such investments, it didn't pan out. So there's definitely kind of a spirit that I think pervades, most people that live there, many people that live there.
Right, right. We point out in the story that we're not when we talk about developers, we're not talking about Donald Trump. We're talking about small-time developers, and one political scientist we talked to spoke about the tyranny of the small developer. But really, these are people who often live in the neighborhoods where they build, and they were affected themselves.
So what do you mean by the tyranny of the small developer?
It's less a case of a big developer coming in and putting up a huge tower. And more a case of many people throughout the borough having an interest in building and having ties, having political ties. And, there's a continuum, but a lot of people on the island have tools and expand their homes and do a lot of building themselves. And then there are people kind of farther up the chain who build more. Extensively.
Have they built with any sense of Staten Island's situation? The problems that could be caused by a storm like Sandy?
Well, one of the most interesting parts of our reporting experience was we took a trip with three professors from the College of Staten Island to tour the damaged areas. And, one of them was a geologist who has using this, very high-tech computer mapping system, studied the flood zones, development in the flood zones from 1900 until the present. And the others were, economists and public policy people. And all of them together have, spent years trying to, garner interest about the issue of how do you develop in these flood zones and should you? And if you do, what kind of precautions that you need to take? And essentially they all agreed, this is one of the few things that they did completely agree on, which is that there hasn't been an eye towards protecting from flooding and protecting from storms in development.
So there's been no seawall.
Well, there are, you know, there are sort of small seawalls and parts of it that have been battered. And you know, more than anything, there's been no comprehensive, you know, sense of we are building in a dangerous place, therefore we must take extremely strong precautions.
Now, after the seawall that used to be there was damaged in a nor'easter, the Army Corps of Engineers planned to rebuild it and a berm, but then decided to scrap the plan. Why?
Well, it ended up being too expensive to rebuild the seawall, so they came up with another plan.
Levees.
Levees. They decided
that
to build...
worked really well in New Orleans, didn't it?
They decided to build two levees and a floodgate, and in the end, they ended up only building one levee. The second levee that they wanted to build was supposed to be a little farther inland, and it was supposed to keep water from running from this sort of inland area, from an inland creek, down to the shore. They did not end up building that levee. Instead, they raised roads and they took some other measures. But shortly after they announced their plans to build that levee, the city council approved an application from developers who wanted to buy that parts of that land from the city. And developers ended up putting up townhouses on the property where the levee was supposed to be built.
So the economics of building over overrode the any attempt to spend money to protect the people who lived on the island.
A lot of people definitely feel that way.
So the penny wise, pound foolish. My guests are Lila Shapiro, Saki Knafo. Their article, The Forgotten Borough, was in the Huffington Post, and we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Saki Knafo and Lila Shapiro. Their article, The Forgotten Borough, was in this week's Huffington Post, and you begin by telling about one Staten Islander's experience the night that Sandy struck. How did you come across Pedro Correa?
Trying to remember how I met him exactly. We were just down there a few days after the storm. Actually, the first time I met him, he was walking around a marsh that was filled with debris, basically just filled with the remnants of people's homes.
This is where the second levee was proposed?
No, it was a different marsh. Uh-huh. There are a lot of marshes there. But he was walking around there with a friend, and they were trying to find his house, which had ended up in the marsh, so that he could retrieve some belongings from it.
Uh-huh. So, but it was built in an area that we now might say was unsafe?
Yeah. Yeah.
So why was that allowed?
I mean, the houses that were along Kissam, which is a street that essentially, you know, sit only there were 17 houses, and I think only three are still on their foundations now. I mean, all of those houses were, you know, essentially summer bungalows that, you know, over the years people, you know, saw a great deal. You know, they saw I can get, you know, for, you know, far less money than in Long Island, New Jersey, I can buy a house with an in-ground pool, you know, right on the beach. And it was this beautiful place. And, you know, it was never, by the time people were even aware of, you know, like there was a kind of, in 2003, there was a task force looking into this stuff, but those houses were already built. And there was no sense to kind of going back to the past and redoing something, you know, where people have been living.
But they've been flooding in that neighborhood before. The homeowners, like Mr. Correa on Kissam Avenue, hadn't been told that it was prone to flooding.
Right, right. I mean, I think everyone had a different level of awareness. But Correa was someone who, like a lot of people from Staten Island, he came from Brooklyn, from a crowded neighborhood in Brooklyn. And he came out to Staten Island and... He walked down this street with a real estate agent, and the street stretches out into the marsh. It's marshland on both sides, and you could tell even after the storm when it's all in ruins, you could tell it must have been beautiful. There was an eagle that perched in his neighbor's tree. There were, you know, deer running around his backyard, And it was a chance to live in a beautiful, serene place that he thought he'd never be able to afford. He was a corrections officer.
You say he never imagined that his corrections officer's salary could afford him a third of an acre, a deck with ocean views, and an in-ground pool. And his neighbors had similar situations?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of them came over earlier or they were born there, but... But even in previous generations, you just had a lot of people who were drawn to the sea. A lot of folks who maybe lived in Hell's Kitchen or lived in Brooklyn and had a summer home there. And then there came to be a point where they couldn't afford both. So they thought, do we stay in the tenement or do we stay in the beautiful seaside house?
Now, as I understand the history of housing, for a long time, poor people were pushed to live along the shorelines. It's only later that it became a favorite place for wealthy people. Was that true in Staten Island as well?
Well, most of Staten Island along the shore was really summer bungalows. It wasn't, you know, some place for the most part where, you know, people were kind of living full time, you know, because they couldn't afford to live anywhere else.
So then they winterized these homes?
Then they winterized the homes.
It wasn't like in Rockaway, where there aren't projects in this area of Staten Island. There aren't housing projects. The city didn't put homes there for the very poor. But what you did have were working class people who made enough money to be able to buy something there and get a little grass to cut, but didn't have enough money to move further down to the Jersey Shore or to move to Long Island.
Now, luckily, Mr. Correa wasn't killed in the storm, but why didn't he listen to the local government's mandatory evacuation warnings?
I mean, this is something that I think a lot of people on Staten Island who stayed are still struggling with. And, you know, there are two things that came up a lot in conversation, both tied to the hurricane the year before, Irene.
A fire broke out in the neighborhood after Irene, didn't it? And Correa didn't leave during...
The fire was before, but he didn't leave then either. And, you know, there's a mentality that, you know, a lot of these people, Correa, he put his whole, you know, all of his investment was in this house. That was all of his financial, you know, worth basically was tied up in this house and all of his time as well. And so I think, you know, and a lot of his neighbors were the same way. And so they felt, you know, we need to protect what's ours. And during Irene, when there were mandatory evacuation orders, you know, he didn't leave, but many other people did. And there was looting or rumors of looting, you know, that loom really large.
A lot of people also stayed behind to pump out their basements. They actually have these pumps that you have to, like, stay behind and operate them in order for them to work. So the water would rise. They would do this year after year during floods. The water would come in. And, you know, someone would stay behind and pump out the water and keep it from getting high enough to destroy the house.
And is that why some of them died?
Well, probably. I mean, a few of the people who died in this neighborhood were found in their basements.
Well, you write a lot about the general apprehension of many Staten Islanders toward government. Didn't the borough's representatives actually vote to secede from New York City in the 90s?
Yeah.
So what prevented them from doing that?
The state legislature, which was controlled by Democrats.
But do you think that anti-city government sentiment plays a role in what we've been talking about?
Definitely.
Yeah, I think that there's this sense that, you know, people feel very self-reliant and they think we take care of ourselves and we take care of each other. And, you know, who is the government to tell us when to get out or what to do with our property?
And this wasn't the only neighborhood that got hit this way. There was the New York Times published a story on a neighborhood 2.5 miles north of Oakwood Beach called Midland Beach, where many other residents were killed. Were both neighborhoods built under similar circumstances, homes on marshland that was easily prone to flooding?
Yeah.
There's a street called Highland Boulevard that runs along the shore, and it's generally known on the island that if you build below Highland Boulevard, between Highland Boulevard and the water, then you will have flooding. And that's sort of something that, you know, that everyone basically knows, but, you know, it's never prevented people from wanting to live there.
My guests are Lila Shapiro and Saki Knafo, whose article, The Forgotten Borough, was on the Huffington Post this week. Mr. Correa led city officials on a tour of Kissam Avenue after the storm, and one of them said that it was obvious developers or politicians, by allowing developers to build there, had defied a law that prevents wetlands from being filled in for development purposes. Has anybody been penalized?
I think you're referring to a guy named Anthony Licciardello. He was a low-ranking Bloomberg official, and he lived in Staten Island, and he took officials on a tour of Correa's street back in 2005. And there's a state law that prohibits people from filling in wetlands and from developing homes there. And he could see that people had defied it. Even if their homes were built legally, they'd kind of expanded the backyards and filled in wetlands. And he asked a state official about this, and the official told him that you can't really enforce this law unless you catch someone in the act of filling in this property.
John from the Upper West Side wrote in to say that when you have a house on the shore, you need insurance on panhandle houses on shore on stilts survive. Now, were all these people able to get flood insurance?
I don't know about all of them, but...
Did Pedro Correa?
Pedro had flood insurance, yeah.
So that makes it a little easier for him. How bad is the damage to his house?
His house is now sitting about 100 feet away from it where it used to be, on an angle in a marsh, and flood insurance will only cover part of that. So I actually went out there with him and some people from the insurance agency, and he was trying to demonstrate to them that the damage was caused by more than just a flood. And essentially what happened was that this wave knocked another old house off its foundation and turned it into a battering ram that hit his house and caused it to be swept away.
Sounds like what happens with an accident on the highway.
Yeah.
One car hits another one, and then, but it, with houses, it's got to be even scarier. How have Staten Island's inclinations toward conservative politics affected the way that they've dealt with the Sandy aftermath? From what you've seen, has the storm done anything to change the attitudes of any of the residents?
I don't know if people's attitudes are changing about their political inclinations, but I think people's attitudes are changing about wanting to continue to live in the neighborhood. I don't think that there's from people that we've interviewed who live there, it's not as though they're saying suddenly, like, this is so terrible, I'm going to be a Democrat. It's more like, this is so terrible and I don't want to live here anymore. So it's become, I think, intensely personal for a lot of people. And they try not to see it in political views. You know, this community meeting that we went to where, you know, hundreds of residents from the neighborhood were there trying to decide, you know, the next steps. The woman who led the meeting, named Tina Downer, she said one of her opening lines was like, this is not political. This is, you know, this is about our lives. And so I think that there's a real, among these kind of conservative, you know, she's a Ron Paul activist, in fact.
But you're suggesting that there is a political side because Staten Island, as we said earlier, was run by the real estate party.
Right. There's a strong libertarian ethos there. And the feeling among a lot of Staten Islanders, they are underrepresented in the city council, right? They only have three representatives in a 51-member city council.
Because of the smallness of the population?
It's the smallness of the population, but at the same time, they have 500,000 people. And, you know, there are cities that have 500,000 people. The difference is those cities get to determine their own policies. That's not necessarily the case if you have such a small number of representatives.
And, of course, the most famous example of that is the city's decision, you know, to turn part of Staten Island into a landfill. And
right.
the resentment of that, you know, decades ago is still very strong.
Now, we saw the Occupy movement making a big impact on the recoveries in Rockaway and Red Hook. Were they on Staten Island as well?
Yes.
The New York Times reported that the city was planning to close one of the most helpful aid stations in Staten Island, 489 Midland Avenue. Are you familiar with that situation?
No.
But you have to ask why the city would want to close a helpful aid station in an area that is so slow to recover. Is Staten Island in worse shape than the Rockaways and Red Hook? Do we know?
I wouldn't really know how to begin to compare that. I mean, there were, you know, more casualties there than anywhere else. So in that sense, yes.
Are we hearing anything about rezoning these areas?
Bloomberg has said that he will be reconvening a task force that was supposed to that did look into overdevelopment on Staten Island back in 2003. And so some of the people who sat on that task force are going to be getting together to look at how to rebuild.
Now, many families lost their homes. Are there FEMA trailers on Staten Island?
I haven't seen any FEMA trailers.
But there was
FEMA these people staying
on Staten Island.
Pedro rented. He got a 3-month lease on an apartment in a neighborhood on higher ground.
Well, the city did set up a program called Rapid Repair, where contractors will at least try to put together a homeowner's heat, hot water, and power so that they can stay in their homes while they complete other larger renovations. Are you seeing that?
I mean, in this neighborhood, many of the places are so damaged that, you know, the last time we were out there, which is, you know, 2 weeks ago, you know, there was still nobody was going back to the homes of the kind of, you know, right along the water. I mean, you know, not some of them are not even on their foundations. Others have so much of this, like, kind of sludge in it that it's just, it's, you know, there's a lot of anxiety about, you know, asbestos and other sorts of toxins from the water. So, you know, I mean, there are definitely areas where people are back in their homes, but right along the water in Oakwood Beach, not so much.
Lila Shapiro and Saki Knafo, their article, The Forgotten Borough, was in this week's Huffington Post. Thank you both so much for being on our show today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.